Welcome, everyone, to Unconventional Lifestyles. I am your host, Whit Aldridge, and this podcast is all about exploring people's lifestyles who are living unconventionally. I aim not only to entertain listeners, but also to expand the mindset of thinking outside of the status quo. From digital nomads and expats living abroad, to seasonal workers and people working remotely, I will reveal my story and life experiences through conversations with people who I think have interesting stories as well. So stay tuned and get inspired. On today's show, we have Lily Simonson, and Lily is an artist who frequently embeds in research expeditions to remote environments. Her immersive large-scale paintings of bizarre environments and animals aim to transport viewers to far-flung worlds and expose them to new discoveries. Simonson spent 3 months scuba diving and camping in Antarctica as the 2014-15 National Science Foundation Antarctic Artist and Writers Awardee. She has also served as the resident artist aboard oceanographic expeditions on research vessels Atlantis and Melville, and the exploration vessel Nautilus. Her works have been exhibited across the United States and Europe, and her art has appeared in a range of media outlets, including Interview Magazine, Atlas Obscura, The LA Times, Smithsonian Magazine, LA Weekly, MTV, and CBS. She holds an MFA from UCLA, and a BA from UC Berkeley, and has taught painting at UC Berkeley and Cal Poly Pomona. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Lily.
Hey, how's it going?
It's really good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Yeah, I'm excited to be on your podcast. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, the pleasure's all on this side of the microphone. I'll tell you that right now. You've got a fascinating story, and I can't wait to share it with the world. So you've carved out a very interesting niche combining art with science. And you're not a scientist per se, but you've always been interested in science and you work exclusively with scientists. So what exactly do you do, Lily?
Well, I am a painter and I always studied art. I didn't really have a background in science, but when I was in grad school, I got interested in painting specific deep sea animals. And from there, I started working directly with scientists just to observe the things I was interested in. And now it's sort of turned into this trajectory where I go into the field with oceanographers and biologists and geologists on different expeditions and make paintings based on what they're looking at. So it's something I never expected to happen, but it's been really interesting being at this intersection of art and science.
Do you know of anybody else that's really kind of doing this kind of work that you're doing?
Well, yeah, there's, there's this incredible history of science and art working in tandem. Like we used to think of them as the same thing centuries ago. I mean, the biggest example of that is Da Vinci. And today I think of myself as being part of this sort of lineage of natural illustration and artists as explorers. But the context has totally changed because now we have photography that sort of documents new discoveries. So as a painter, I get to describe not just what things look like, but what it feels like to be there and to examine them. And I get to capture something about the atmosphere and the feeling of my subjects. And there totally are artists today with similar paths, but I think, I don't know, my niche is kind of unusual.
I agree with that, and I think it's fascinating. Obviously, that's why I have you on the podcast today. But what's your background, and how did you get into such a defined niche?
Ever since I was a little kid, I was really into specifically drawing like sea creatures. I always made little drawings and paintings of like clams and seaweed and fish and especially lobsters. Like I was always into drawing lobsters. And then when I was in college and becoming really interested in painting and becoming a painter, I did this series of giant lobster portraits. And I didn't really like, you know, I was young. It was kind of this idiosyncratic interest where I just thought lobsters looked really cool. And then I kind of moved away from that and got interested in sort of psychological symbolism in painting and began this years-long series of paintings of just moths. And I took up moths as a subject specifically because I had had a phobia of moths as a kid, but I was interested in what it was about moths that sparked that reaction. So it's not like I was working through it, but I was curious about the symbology of moths and especially interested in that weird sort of mammalian furriness that moths have. They're kind of unusual as insects. They've got these like really furry bodies. And so that was one characteristic that really captivated me, and I was focused on that in the paintings. And then when I was in grad school, I was kind of looking for a new muse. And so this is just a funny little serendipitous story that got me started on this path. So one day I opened my inbox and I had like a bunch of emails from different people that were all sending me the same New York Times article announcing the discovery of a new animal called the Yeti crab. And it was described in the article as a lobster with the same kind of fur that moths have on their bodies. So it was this really funny moment where like these two series of paintings that I had been working on seemed to be hybridized in this new creature that was discovered. And so I was just like, God, I have to paint this Yeti crab. It looks really cool. And it's these two things I've been interested in. So I reached out to the scientist that was studying it. There was only one specimen that had been collected. And it was discovered at like 7,000 feet near Easter Island around these hydrothermal vents. And I can get into all of that more too. But from there, when I met the scientist that was studying the Yeti crab, I started thinking about all the parallels between art and science. And from there, I just kind of kept going with those collaborations.
And what are the chances putting that together? I mean, it's like one in a million for that to kind of,
yeah.
It's like the universe just collided
totally,
right in front of you. I'm sure you were sitting there in college like, I like to paint lobsters. Where am I going to go with this? You know, and it turned into something epic. What you're doing is just so awesome. So I think that's just a really cool story about how just turning your passion into your work and, you know, your
and
purpose. I think it's awesome.
It kind of unfolded more from there, where the Yeti crab discovery had come about sort of in part through this organization called the Census of Marine Life, which was documenting all the species or attempting to document all the species known in the ocean and discover new species. And the Yeti crab, because it's got a funny name and it's sort of charismatic, it got a lot of media attention. So it emerged as sort of the mascot for this specific project. And the census people found out about my Yeti crab paintings and invited me to come give a talk in London. This was back in 2010. So I had the chance to give a lecture to and meet scientists from all over the world. And from there, I got invited to visit various labs and see other deep sea creatures. And then I started getting invitations to go to sea. So that's how this sort of collaboration between me and these researchers evolved. And it's it's kind of funny because back in college, I was, you know, making these lobster paintings. It was this really quirky thing. And a couple of my friends prank called me and left me a voicemail that was totally hilarious. It was like, "Hello, this is George Smith from the American Lobster Society. And we've come across your paintings online and we'd like to feature them in our publication, perhaps have you posing with some lobsters on the cover." And they almost got me, but at the time it was like 2003 or 2004 and I didn't have a website yet. So I was like, wait a minute, this is not real. But I was remembering that recently because it was kind of prescient, because I did end up having my work published in these weird like Crustacean Society magazines. And now my painting is in this textbook of squat lobsters. So it was this totally out there prank, but it totally like predicted my path. So it cracks me up. It cracked me up at the time, but now it's even funnier.
What does your work process look like? Where does the inspiration come from and how does it flow through you onto the canvas?
Yeah. Well, I really, really like to work from direct observation. So that was why, you know, when I found out about the Yeti crab, I contacted the scientist who was studying it because I wanted to look at the specimen. So to me, as a painter, painting is this really tactile medium, and there's so much information that you need from a painting that can't really be captured in, say, like a photograph. So what I, what my process often looks like is I'll look at preserved specimens and either borrow them from the lab and bring them to my studio or make sketches of them in the lab, and then turn those into giant paintings. Or if I'm working in the field, it depends on the scenario. Sometimes I'll just make small studies in the field. And sometimes, like the last time I was on an expedition, I had a whole studio space. So I was able to make like pretty large paintings while I was at sea. So being in the field is absolutely the best because then I get to see the organisms when they're still alive, like freshly collected, and they still have all their pigmentation and they're still moving. Or if I'm doing something more landscape focused, I can really experience the scenery and move around inside it as I'm painting it. So it makes it's really great for me to be able to accompany the researchers. And then also I'm there for the actual research and I can help gather data and assist with experiments. And that actually lends a whole new level of depth to my work where I can then relay like really specific details of the research to my audience. So usually I do work in the field and then I'll finish the paintings in my studio. And typically they're sort of mural scale or at least bigger than human size. And then my work is usually lots and lots of thin layers. Like I love the aesthetic of like Dutch still lifes and Renaissance painting. So I use lots and lots of glazes to create this sort of luminous quality. I'll spend maybe like 6 months on a painting often. Sometimes it's quicker, sometimes it takes a little longer. And then usually I show my work in a gallery context, but that varies too where I exhibit.
And the paintings are very, I don't know, how would you say it? Fantastical or very, just very vibrant and very overwhelming. I think it's really cool how you take like small subjects and just blow them up.
Thank
to
you.
Great sizes. And it's really inspiring to see these in person.
Thank you.
But with that, and other than like, you know, fulfilling your own passion and, you know, all that, what's the goal of your work? What are you accomplishing with it?
Well, I love that you used the word fantastical because The types of subjects that I paint, these like deep sea organisms or Antarctic sea creatures, are often, and the scenery too, it's often something that my viewers have never seen before. And I love the moment where a viewer will look at my painting and think that it's something that I've invented. And then either I tell them or they discover that, like, no, this crazy looking thing really exists. So there's this like feeling of wonder that gets to happen in the viewer where, you know, they realize that truth really is stranger than fiction. And that was a big part of my own progression as an artist, like with the moth paintings and early on with the Yeti crab paintings, I was very interested in how they functioned as symbols of human ideas. But then the more I started working directly with scientists and the more I discovered about their biological backstories or the research surrounding them, I was like, this is so much more interesting than any idea I would project onto them or way that I would position them. So I got deeper and deeper into just using my paintings as sort of a jumping off point to discuss research. Like, I can't obviously put like all of the ideas from a scientific paper into a painting. I'm not trying to illustrate those ideas, but it is a way to engage viewers who might not have like a science background or might not know about this specific research with new ideas and new discoveries and share just new research with like a broader audience.
It's almost like, in a way, content marketing to open the door, like you were saying, to people that wouldn't be exposed to this kind of stuff. So, you know, it kind of paints a picture for the scientific research.
And
I mean, you're pretty much championing science and exposing the research and findings to people, that necessarily wouldn't be exposed to it otherwise.
Right.
With the work that you're doing. And how has that gotten you into, like, for instance, keynote speaking engagements, and what else has it led to?
Well, I mean, it's this real dialogue that I've developed with my scientific collaborators. So the scientists that I work with kind of see like that there's this opportunity for them to share their work with a broader audience. I think they're, for a few decades in the past, there was this idea that science had to be completely separate from, it had to be pure, and scientists really didn't want to be seen as advocating for one idea or another. But now with, this recognition that human beings are impacting the planet, and our actions really matter. The scientists that I work with who are studying climate change and related fields feel an urgency to share their findings with all kinds of people, not just their peers within their field. So I think that they see art as one vehicle for doing that, for sparking interest in what they're researching. So that's one avenue. And then the other thing is that in turn, they see the value of working with me. So they invite me to come with them on these expeditions. So I've gotten to go to sea, and then the Antarctica thing we'll get into later. But, I think there's been like, scientists are super receptive to working with artists right now because of this sort of cultural shift.
No, that's fascinating. And just as like talking about the Antarctica thing, obviously that's where we met in McMurdo Station. What was your mission there and what were you doing?
Yeah, just to give a little bit of backstory. So I had been painting the Yeti crab, got connected to all these oceanographic institutions and people studying primarily doing deep sea stuff. And one of the deep sea researchers who discovered a new species of Yeti crab around 2010, Andrew Thurber, I'd been working with him, and he, you know, was like, oh, hey, I happen to have discovered this Yeti crab, but actually my main focus is these worms in Antarctica. And he showed me images of life underneath the sea ice in Antarctica and what the sea ice there looks like. And I was just blown away. I was like, that is the most beautiful thing on the planet. I really want to paint it. And I obviously, in order to paint it, I need to see it for myself. And Andrew was like, well, you're in luck because the National Science Foundation has this program called the Antarctic Artists and Writers Program, where each year, along with all the researchers that work out of the various stations in Antarctica, the government sends one artist or writer to sort of embed with the researchers and make work about, inspired by whatever it is they're doing. So that's how I got down there. And so I was there for 3 months. And the first month was focused on diving. And so the ocean there is covered in like 6 feet of sea ice. And they'll blast holes at different sites around it's in the McMurdo Sound is the body of water we're looking at. So they blast different holes, and then we dive down through the hole and, you know, do whatever we need to do. I mostly just like swam around and took video and got inspired. And then I also got to collect organisms that I wanted to paint. And we'd head back to the research station, and I'd keep the animals alive in an aquarium there in the touch tank. And then I got to use them as models for my paintings. So I had like a little studio set up on station, and I'd go down to the touch tank and, you know, look at whatever it was I'd collected and paint it. So yeah, that was my daily life on station.
And we haven't mentioned it yet, but clearly you are a scuba diver as well.
Yes.
And did you get into scuba diving because of your love for like these sea creatures and just to get a firsthand look, or was that something you've always done, or is it recent, or how'd you go about that?
Yeah, well, I actually had not done any diving to speak of until I got the idea in my head that I wanted to dive in Antarctica. So I basically learned to dive so that I could write a proposal to the NSF saying that I wanted to dive in Antarctica. And you obviously have to be pretty experienced to dive under the sea ice. So by the time I got down there, I had done about 100 dives. But it was all because I wanted to dive there. And I was telling you when we chatted before that it's kind of spoiled me, because it is the most amazing diving I could ever imagine. Like, it's just, diving is always really fun. It always feels like you're in a parallel universe when you're, you know, breathing underwater. Like, how crazy is that? And there's always cool stuff to see. But Antarctica is really special, especially that particular area where the research station is at McMurdo Sound.
What's it like diving under ice? If you could just kind of like walk us through and paint that picture, what it's like down
there.
What, why did you get spoiled by this particular place diving?
Yeah. Well, so on top, the sea ice is pretty smooth and white. But then underneath it, it has this algae that grows in the ice itself, microalgae called diatoms. And the sea ice changes from like turquoise to neon green to gold. And the sun, when it's shining through it, it just makes it glow this incredibly like luminous, super psychedelic glow. And then the texture of the ice is different at every spot we dive at, and it changes from year to year. But when I was there, it was almost like feathers, like the ice, they call it brash ice. It's super crystalline, And so there are all these little platelets covering the underside of the sea ice. And it looks like, yeah, like fur or feathers. It's just the most amazing, beautiful texture. And then there are these things called brinicles or brine channels, where super salty water collects in these channels and freezes on the outside. And so they look like stalagmites or stalactites in a cave, except they're glowing and glowing these crazy like neon colors. Yeah, the formations are just insane. And the visibility is like off the hook because it's been dark for months and months when we start diving. So it's been winter, it's been dark, and so there's almost nothing growing in the water. So you can see like 1,000 feet, which is almost unheard of. And it feels like you're not even in water. Like it feels like you're flying through the air. And it's really interesting because early on in the season, it's super clear and it stays that way through basically springtime in Antarctica. So like October, November, and early December, the water is crazy clear like that. And then in early December, as the sun is getting higher in the sky, there's a plankton bloom and the visibility drops from like 1,000 feet to 10 feet, which is totally mind blowing.
Wow, that is insane.
Yeah. And then the other crazy thing is like there's no seaweed or anything. So you can see all the animals perfectly clearly. So the visibility is amazing. And then it's just this beautiful like volcanic seafloor. So there's almost no like sediment to disrupt the visibility. And the seafloor is just covered in sea stars and urchin and isopods and these beautiful purple worms, and there are seals just like chilling all around you. It's by far the most amazing thing like I've ever seen in my whole life, and I think about going back all the time.
How do you regulate your body temperature? I mean, are you wearing like specialized insulating wetsuit or whatever, but I mean, what does that process look like?
Like how do you deal with the cold temperatures?
Yeah, because obviously you're in below freezing water, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's
because salt water freezes at a lower temperature, so like the water is -2, and fish in Antarctica actually have evolved antifreeze in their blood.
That's awesome.
Yeah, because otherwise their blood would freeze. So yeah, you wear a dry suit. So it's kind of like an astronaut suit or something. So it's sealed so no water gets in. And then underneath it, you wear like an undergarment that basically looks like the Michelin Man or something. Like it's like a sleeping bag with limbs. It's like the coziest thing you can ever imagine. But even wearing all that, it's still really really cold. Like,
I mean, your face is still like, exposed, right? Like
around
the cheeks and whatnot.
Yeah, your face is exposed. Actually, the face is the one thing that doesn't feel cold because it just goes numb right away. But then that gets a little tricky because when you're scuba diving, you have that mouthpiece. It's called a regulator in your mouth. So there were a couple times where I was diving where it just, you know, your whole jaw is numb. So you forget that you, like you can't tell whether you're holding that in place or not. So it just kind of, you're not careful. It just drops out. You got to pick it up and put it back in your mouth again. Yeah. So that's the downside of having a numb face. Other than that, it keeps your face, you know, pretty comfortable. But I have friends that dove, like oceanography friends that dove in Antarctica in the 60s and 70s, just in wetsuits, which I don't even understand. Yeah. For like an hour. It's pretty
amazing.
That's
insane.
Yeah, they're legends. Paul Dayton and Dave Checkley. Yeah. Really.
Well, kudos to them and kudos to you. And yeah.
They drank a lot of beer back then. That's what they said to me.
That was the antifreeze in their blood.
Yeah,
huh?
Exactly.
It was the alcohol.
Exactly.
While we're on the topic of Antarctica, I want to go back to the Yeti crab. I came across a news story while doing some research, and I just wanted to play the audio for you. This was published back in 2015. I just want to play the audio for you and just get your feedback on what you thought. Is that cool with you?
A newly discovered species of crab is kind of a strange little guy. It's blind, it's hairy, it loves the heat, and it lives in Antarctica. It's called the Yeti crab. And according to a paper published in the journal PLOS ONE, the Kiwa tyleri is only the third known species of Yeti crab. Researchers from the University of Southampton discovered thriving communities of the white, blind, hairy-chested crabs living at 8,500 feet below the surface. Now, I probably don't have to tell you, that's a pretty harsh environment. But they live in a Goldilocks type of situation. Their homes are sandwiched in between near-freezing water and hydrothermal vents that shoot out water that can reach 700 degrees Fahrenheit. One is too hot and one is too cold, so they live in little pockets in between that are just right. And they create their own food by growing bacteria on those bristly chests. How cool is this Yeti crab? For Newsbeat Social, I'm Molly Real.
So what do you think about that?
She's talking about the third Yeti crab species that was discovered. That instead of having hair or seedy fur, it's like fur, but it's called seedy, on its pincers, it has it on its underbelly or its chest. And so it's nicknamed the Hoff crab after David Hasselhoff. And yeah, it does live in the Southern Ocean, but not that close to the area of Antarctica that we were in. So it lives around hydrothermal vents, really deep, I believe on the Scotia Ridge, which is closer to the peninsula side, so maybe not even like below the Antarctic Circle. But yeah, as far south as we were at McMurdo, I think around 75 degrees, there are no decapods. So with climate change, decapods like lobsters and crabs are starting to move further south, but I certainly didn't see any diving there.
I love the fact that David Hasselhoff has worked his way into the science community. Okay, so flipping the conversation a little bit now. Mm-hmm. When I first met you, you were wearing a hot dog costume, and you were painting portraits of people at this art festival in McMurdo. We called it Freezing Man. It's kind of a play on Burning Man, you know, in the Frozen Con. I think everybody gets it. And this hot dog costume continued to appear throughout your stay. Lily, what is the deal with this hot dog costume?
Well, actually, I didn't get to tell you this before, but the hot dog costume goes back to the original Burning Man in the Northern Hemisphere. Which is, I work for Burning Man seasonally, and so I'm there for like a month before the event starts. And a few years ago, a friend of mine showed up, and she was like, I have a present for you. And she pulled out this hot dog costume. She was like, I found this in my uncle's basement, and I thought of you. I don't know why. So I put it on. I was like wearing it around. And then another friend of mine was like, you're never going to take that off, are you? And it wasn't my plan to never take it off. But as soon as she said that, I was like, challenge accepted.
Yeah.
And so I wore it to work every day for like a month and was doing construction and like 110 degree heat, wearing the hot dog costume, just because I like to, you know, I like to fully commit to a joke. Like,
oh, for sure.
Fall in. So it sort of became part of my identity. I was like, well, wait a minute. Anybody can wear a hot dog costume at Burning Man. Like, that's not that interesting. So then I started wearing it around like LA when I was living there. I'd like wear it to Starbucks or whatever. Just, like, super cash. And I was doing my checkout dives in Northern California for Antarctica before I left. And my friend Henry Kaiser was like, oh, you got to bring that to my McMurdo. They'll love it down there. So that was part of my 70 pounds was the hot dog costume.
Yeah, costumes are huge down there. I actually took a couple myself. I was blown away when my buddy that got me the job there is like, you got to pack costumes. I'm like, what is this guy talking about? Like, I'm worried about freezing to death, and you want me to get costumes? But no, it's a real thing. It really is.
Yeah. So then I busted it out at Freezing Man and wore it around there. And then I realized, you know, I'm one of several dozen people that have been scuba diving underneath the sea ice in Antarctica. But how many of them have done it in a hot dog costume? I may be the first. So I asked the divers if it was cool if I just put on the hot dog over my gear. And they said, no problem. So I wore it on a few dives. Yeah. Yeah, I wore it to celebrate my 25th dive. And then I just kept wearing it towards the end there. I waited until I was super comfortable. But it was a great addition to the gear, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And folks, if you've got to see this photograph, if you haven't seen it, it's Lily's profile picture on the podcast. So just visit unconventionallifestyles.com and check out this photograph, or you can check it out on her Facebook page as well. But it's just, I love that story. It's just great. So Lily, besides doing the ocean biology work underwater, under the sea ice, you were actually out in the field with other scientists as well. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I spent the first month diving every day, but then the next 2 months I was on land in Antarctica at different field sites. So I spent about a week up on Mount Erebus, which is the southernmost active volcano on the planet. And I was camping up there and making paintings inspired by the crater of the volcano and these incredible ice caves that are formed by fumes coming out from the volcano. And after that, I got to spend many weeks out in this area called the Dry Valleys, which is the only part of Antarctica that's not completely ice covered. And I was with biologists who were studying the critters that live in that soil. So they used to think that no animals could live on land, that they were all in the water. But then this scientist, Diana Wall, discovered that there are actually microorganisms that live in the soil. So I was helping them run experiments and collecting the organisms and then put them under the microscope. And then I also got to hang out with geologists. So I got sort of lured in by the landscape. One of them, Joe Levy, studies the way water behaves in Antarctica, because it's similar to how water would behave on Mars. So both places are really, really cold and really, really dry. So that's kind of exciting, like the way water acts in Antarctica is sort of the closest we can get to the way it would act on Mars. So it kind of, and any possibilities for water and life on Mars. So that was pretty exciting. Sort of out in the fields, all the features that they were studying. So they'd be carrying rocks around and I'd be carrying my paints around and setting up at different spots. It was really spectacular.
Now that is fascinating. And going back to the Dry Valleys, why, or do you know why that it's the only place that's not covered completely with like ice and snow?
Well, it has to do, first of all, so during the last ice age, glaciers moved over the top of it and left all this, they call it till. So it's sediment that gets stuck in the glacier. And then there's also been volcanic activity in that area. A lot of Antarctica is volcanic. But on top of that, the reason that no precipitation sticks basically is because it is so windy there. So it's one of the windiest, harshest places on the planet. And what people don't often realize about Antarctica is that it is a desert. So there's not a ton of precipitation to begin with, but even when it does snow, it gets blown off And something else kind of cool about the dry valleys is they used to think that it was just dirt, and then they discovered that there's ice underneath all the dirt. So one of the features that we were studying is a buried glacier in an area called Garwood Valley, where a river that runs in the summer has eroded it. So you can see all the layers of ice and dirt or till and more ice and more till. So it looks like somebody looked at one of my paintings and said it's like earth lasagna. Feature was being studied because changing weather patterns and increased sunlight are exposing that glacier to increased melting. So it was changing really fast. So Joe and his colleagues were using time-lapse footage to show how that particular spot is really changing, sort of as an indicator for what might be happening in the future on the rest of the continent as temperatures warm.
What's your next adventure?
Well, I am getting ready to go to sea again. So I mentioned sort of in passing that I've been invited on a few different oceanographic expeditions. They call them cruises, but it's not like what we imagine a cruise with, like, shuffleboard and
endless
like
buffets.
All you can eat buffets. Yeah. Although there are sort of, I mean, you can kind of eat as much as you want, and I'm sure they wouldn't be opposed to some shuffleboard, but mostly people are working their butts off. I went to sea once in 2012 with a group from Scripps Oceanographic Institution in San Diego, and we were looking at stuff off the coast of San Diego, and then I got to go to sea again with Bob Ballard, who's an explorer who discovered the remains of the Titanic. That's what he's most well known for. But
that's
he's
awesome.
Really into, yeah, he's great, and he's really into science communication. And so he has a whole program for science communicators. So I applied to go to sea with him back in, 2014 or something, and we were out in the Caribbean looking at an active submarine volcano called Kikumjeni. And then earlier this year, I went to sea with some researchers from Harvard who were looking at tube worms that are these amazing worms that get up to like 6 feet long.
What?
And they have these beautiful, red plumes. And they live inside these white tubes, and they live around hydrothermal vents, which are areas of the seafloor where there's basically, it's like almost like volcanic activity. Water gets sucked down through cracks in the seafloor and then gets superheated and bursts out. And it looks like black smoke, but it's really just super mineral rich water with lots and lots of sulfides and methane in it. So these tube worms actually turn the sulfides into energy. It's called chemosynthesis. So photosynthesis is how plants get energy from light. And then chemosynthesis is this process that was discovered just like 40 years ago, 30 years ago. They discovered these vents where they thought that animals couldn't live in the deep sea because there's no light, so no plants, so no basis for the food chain. But there's this whole other separate food chain of animals that use symbiotic bacteria to turn chemicals into energy. So tube worms were the first animals that were discovered that do that. They're really crazy, really cool looking. So I was out there with biologists that were studying the mechanisms of that bacteria that the tube worm uses to turn the sulfide into energy. And then, so I'm working right now on paintings based on that expedition. And then in May, I get to go to sea again off the coast of Costa Rica in this area called the Pacific Margin, where there's also a lot of geological activity all these seamounts. And instead of hydrothermal vents where the water gets superheated and bursts out with these minerals, methane and sulfide and chemicals sort of seep slowly out from the seafloor. But there are very similar organisms in those areas that, again, turn that methane into energy. So I'm really, really psyched for that expedition because I get to see Yeti crabs, hopefully. So they were discovered in this area where I'm headed, the Pacific Margin. And we'll be using the submarine Alvin. So Alvin is rated to go super, super deep, thousands of feet down. And so we'll be diving in Alvin, check out these deep sea methane seeps. And I hopefully will get to see some Yeti crabs face to face, which is like a dream come true in so many ways. And this type of Yeti crab, this is the species that my friend Andrew discovered. And they actually wave their pinchers above their bodies continuously. So it looks like they're dancing all the time. So Andrew named it Kiwa Pura Vida, which is this Costa Rican term for, like, I don't know the exact translation, but it's like loving life and loving to party. So they're the party Yeti crabs. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to go party with the Yetis.
Yeah. Send my best to them. Have one on me or have one for me.
And it's kind of interesting. The whole project, I mean, is not just focused on Yeti crabs. It's about sort of this spectrum of deep sea life. So it's hyper concentrated around these seeps, these chemical seeps. But then there's this whole gradient of other life forms that as you move out from the seeps, we're going to see how the organisms change and how the geology impacts those organisms. So it's a whole system that we're looking at. So it should be really interesting. And I'll be painting while I'm at sea and then continuing once I get back.
Now, other than, you know, helping the scientists collect data while in the field and, you know, obviously doing your work that you're there to do, what kind of impact do you have on the scientists and the work that they're doing?
Well, it's really cool having this intersection where I'm with people who have a very different background than me. And one of my favorite things about being in the field with scientists is their process takes years, like from the beginning where they conceive of what they want to research to writing a proposal to actually getting in the field to gathering information and then going home, turning that information into a narrative that they can publish in a paper. That's like a years-long process. And, you know, I might take a while to make a painting, but when I'm in the field and I'm painting every day, they get to see sort of immediate impacts of their research. So it's kind of a nice thing, I think, for morale to have me there responding like in real time to what they're studying, and sort of the fruits of their labor are visible and very tangible because they see me just making a painting on the spot inspired by what they're doing. So I think it's obviously really rewarding and helpful to me to be out there and seeing the process of this, the research and the organisms as they're collected or being in that environment. But then I think there's a way in which I relate back to them how their work can have an impact in other ways and in more immediate ways.
Yeah, and I really like that concept, the real-time feedback, you know, like these lengthy process they have to go through. I can definitely see the good in what you're doing to lift morale and get the scientists excited about their work. and keep their morale up. So I think that's fantastic. That's, you know, something you wouldn't necessarily think of until, I guess, you actually get in the field and just watch this symbiotic relationship grow with you and these scientists. And I guess, like, the next time they go out, like, oh no, we got to have Lily. She's got to come with me. She's like my muse, you know?
And it's also nice because after we're done in the field, whenever I have an exhibition of the paintings inspired by their research, I usually invite the scientists to come and give a talk in the gallery or wherever the show is, so that they can have like a, they can use my paintings as a way to discuss their work more in depth with maybe like a more humanities oriented audience that they wouldn't otherwise reach. So that's really fun too. So it continues like that interaction between me and the researchers continues for a long time, even after we get back from Antarctica or the deep sea or wherever it is we are.
That's fascinating. And I just think your whole story is fascinating. It's like at every turn you've taken, it's been like a one in a million chance. And it just like the stars have, you know, just kind of aligned for you. Not to say you haven't put in a lot of hard work and you're a very intelligent person and, you know, the interest level and all that. But I mean, man, this is a great narrative you have here. It's really inspiring.
It's really funny too, because it's something I never could have predicted for myself. I mean, I was always fascinated by the deep sea. Like I was a tube worm for Halloween when I was in second grade. You know, I never thought I would actually have the chance to be on a ship exploring the deep or be under the ice in Antarctica. I was always intimidated by the sciences. So like if you had asked me 20 years ago what I would be doing now, I never would have guessed this. I remember in college, my boyfriend at the time was a physical geography major, and so he was into science. And he was like, Lily, maybe when we're older, I can be a scientist on a ship, and you can be the ship artist. And I was like, there's no such thing as a ship artist. Like, what are you talking about? But yeah, he nailed it.
It's kind of like a vision board. Like I believe in like the laws of attraction and all that. And like your personality, you're just always so bubbly and positive. And I just feel like, yeah, you put this all out in the world and it came back to you. You know, it's really cool. It's really inspiring. And thanks for sharing all this with us.
Yeah. I mean, it all just came out of me like getting interested in these really specific things and just going for it to its like ultimate conclusion. Just like the way I go for it with the hot dog costume. Like,
right.
There's a Yeti crab out there. I'm going to like keep stalking it until I find it.
It just goes to show, just find your passion and what motivates you and just go for it. I forget who said it, but it's like if you do something you love, you'll never work a day in your life. What you've done is that whole concept just embodied and envisioned in your story. And I think it's fantastic. So kudos on all the success and all the great stuff you're putting out there in the world. And, you know, just connecting people. You know, that's my thing is I love to connect people. So just to see what you're doing with being able to, you know, connect, you know, scientists that and their research findings and their work with, you know, humanitarian, you know, associations or organizations where they can get up there like and speak, like your work is like bringing people together. It's just so fascinating. I love that. So don't stop. Keep it up. You're doing great stuff. And I can't wait to see what comes next.
Thanks, Whit.
I've got a couple random mystery questions for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
If you could have drinks with anyone, dead or alive, who would that be and why?
Well, I mean, I want to say something like a Republican leader that disagrees with me so I can convince them not to kill the EPA and climate change is real and stuff. But actually today I'm having more of like an emotional response to that question where My grandmother passed away a few weeks ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
She was 101.
Wow.
Oh, thank
you. She rocked
it. Yeah, sorry to make it heavy. Yeah.
No. It's part of life.
She had a full life. She was 101. And I mean, I told her I loved her a million times, but I still, I'm feeling her loss. And I feel like she's just the person I would pick if I could, if I had the chance to see her again. I would love to. And she was just always such an inspiration to me. She's like my biggest supporter as a painter. And then her whole life, she was an activist and fought for racial equality and founded her own chapter of the ACLU and just had a knack for figuring out how to make positive change in the world. And I feel like we're in kind of a dark place politically, and I wish I could just ask her, like, what should we do to help the world become a better place? Because she really did her part, and I want to follow her in her footsteps. So I find myself wishing that I could just have one more conversation with her. She really had a lot figured out.
I feel very similar to you. My grandfather, you know, fought in World War II, the whole nine, just a great impact on the community around him. I remember he passed away when I was at a young age, but I was getting to that age where I realized, like, man, this guy's like, he's a pillar of the community, and he's like, I could feel his energy. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's when I started noticing things. And then soon after that, it's just like, you know, he passed away, but I've thought about this a lot, and he still inspires me a lot. What I would give just to, you know, sit down and have a conversation with him as an adult, you know, cause I was like maybe 9 or 12 or something like that when he passed. But a lot of times I just think, What would Papaw have done? What would he think about this? You know, so it's kind of like one of those things where it's like, you can't, he's not here now, but he still kind of guides me, like what you were saying. Kind of, he's continuing to make me a better person, I think, just because of the role model that he was and the great things he accomplished and all that as well. So I feel you there.
Totally. And it's how you can help your ancestors live on through you is
totally,
you know, reflecting on their values and enacting those values. And I mean, I'm not a spiritual person, but I do think that I can kind of keep her alive by continuing her trajectory of activism and stuff. But same page. And tell the people around you that you love them. That's so important.
And mean it too, you know? Just love hard and freely and open your heart, people. Love the people around you. And if you don't love them, get them out of there. And, you know, find the people you love and open your heart and spread that love out in the world. At any rate, rant over. This may be a silly question, but I just want to throw it out there. If money was not an option, what would you do with your time?
Yeah. You know, I feel like I'm living a really special life right now. I'm super happy. The only thing that I think I would change if money was not an issue, I would just give my paintings away. I like that my work has value to people. But I wish that, you know, if somebody wanted a painting, I could just say, like, just take it, or like, let's trade for something. Like, I would love to be successful enough or wealthy enough where I could just give my art away to people who would enjoy it the most. That's what I really want.
And I kind of figured that would kind of be the answer to this question, but moving right along, if you could hijack an Amber Alert sign on the highway, or as you call it in LA, the freeway, what message would you get across?
I think what I wish most people, you know, what I want the world to do differently is to just be more open-minded to new ideas. I think, you know what I would say? I would say, like, think critically. Like, I think we're on both sides politically, we're not thinking critically. We're just entrenched in our own ideology. And I want people to really think ideas through.
Before we go, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you would like to talk about?
Well, you did ask a question about other artists that work the way I do. And I wanted to mention again, like, this lineage of, like, this the artist as explorer, because I do have a lot of influences throughout history, like this woman, Maria Silvia Marion, who was a German artist in the 17th century. She sold her paintings to fund her own expeditions and traveled around the world. She left her husband and traveled around the world with her daughters and painted scenes from the natural world, and actually was the first person to discover that, like, butterflies start as caterpillars and metamorphosize. And she basically, like, foretold the whole field of ecology. And Audubon, I learned to draw from copying Audubon drawings, and he, you know, explored North America and documented new species of birds and other wildlife by painting them, and exposed Europeans to this whole world across the ocean through his paintings. And I kind of feel like where we are with the deep sea, so much of it is just being explored. And the same with Antarctica. It's this new territory where we're constantly discovering new species and new aspects of ecology. And as a painter traveling to those areas and interested in that stuff, I get to use my paintings to share these discoveries. So I see myself as very aligned with that tradition and just where we were in sort of the golden age of discovery of the terrestrial world. I feel like that's where we are now with the deep ocean. So it's a really cool moment in scientific history, I think, that I get to be part of. And then today, I think there are a lot of artists who are interested in science, and each in their own unique way. I mean, the artist and writer program in Antarctica is also kind of inspired, I think, by that Audubon tradition, where most of the public will not ever go to Antarctica at this stage of the world. And so the artists that get sent by our government, their job is to sort of share what it's like to be down there. So there are a bunch of different artists who have done the program that I've done, because they choose one or two each year. That there's a whole sort of niche right there of Antarctic artists. And there are a few other artists who go to sea too. Like there's this artist that I just had the pleasure of meeting, Rebecca Rutstein, who makes paintings based on, like, the geology of the seafloor. There's a whole artist at sea program that the Schmidt Ocean Institute is developing, where they select artists to go out on their research vessels. So I definitely want to acknowledge that I'm not the only one, but I think we each have our own take on it and our own unique style. So, yeah.
Well, once again, kudos on all the great success and all that you've accomplished. It's very inspiring. And I know my audience will get value from this conversation, but where can people find or follow you and the work you're doing online?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have a website. I actually have a couple websites. One of them is Old Genres, OLDGENRES nujournals.com. Which is sort of like an art joke, like new genres is like performance and video. And so I think of painting as old genres. So that's my older website. And then my new website is just my name, lilysimonson.com. And of course, I'm on all the social medias on Instagram. You look up my name and Facebook and all that.
Awesome. Well, I will be sure to check that out as well. And I really appreciate you being on the show today, Lily.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I have become a fan of your podcast. You find really cool people, so I'm honored to be part of it.
Yeah, you've joined the ranks, and I'm honored to have you, truly, honestly, from the bottom of my heart. I mean, it's people like you that make this thing that work. I'm just trying to be the messenger to carry forth out into the world and share your message. So,
well, you yeah. lead a pretty unconventional life. When are you going to have somebody interview you with?
You know, I don't know.
I'll volunteer.
Okay. I've had people suggest that nobody's really made a valid effort, and I think in due time we should do something like that. But yeah, let's talk about it more, and we should do it again sometime, and maybe after your trip to Costa Rica.
Yeah, I can update you.
Yeah. Come back for a live update. Maybe we'll do like, you know, just a quick update.
That would be cool.
Okay. Well, let's plan on that. How about that?
Okay. Awesome.
All right, Lily. Well, I appreciate you being on the show today.
I can call you via satellite.
What's that?
I can call you via satellite.
That would be cool. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Bye.
All right, bye. Today's episode was produced in part by myself, your host, Whit Aldridge, as well as executive producer Monica Shefflow. If you are interested in learning more about sponsorship incentives, or if you have someone in mind in which you would recommend to be interviewed on the podcast, then email me at whit@whitaldridge.com. That's whit@whitaldridge.com. I've been your host, Whit Aldridge, and I look forward to next time.